What is happening? Welcome to another episode of The Craft. My name is Nick Pollock, and it is a new year. I'm a new man, okay? And I figured, you know what? I should have the newest of men, Eno Saris, join me for my podcast. Eno, I don't know why you're new, but you are to me. Always, with that smile on your face, it's just, I feel new. How you doing?
We've never done this before. Hey, so happy to see you since the wedding. That was a great time. We had a great time. There was a contingent. There's two tables that did not stop talking baseball.
Yeah, I put the as my wife says. Oh my gosh, my wife says the Base Boys. That is the name of everyone I'm associated with in baseball. It's B-O-I-Z, and I put the Base Boys together.
I had a real fun time because I came to the night before too. I got to know your sister really well.
Yeah.
She gave me some tips on how to pay more of my home bills with my credit cards to rack up points.
Yeah. So she's obsessed with them, and that's how she gets all her hotels and everything is through points.
Yeah. So that was good. I bonded with your father over music. He's got this whole history of music that's amazing. He was involved with a lot of great moments in music. And then I bonded. I'm forgetting his name for a second. It's your basketball manager.
Oh yeah, also Malcolm.
Yes, that's right. There's Malcolm
Seymour-Jones. He's the head coach now. I'm assistant because I can't do it forever. I used to coach him when I was 23. And he became my assistant coach after that. Yeah, he's awesome. Oh, I'm so glad.
I got to meet them. And then, of course, all the baseball people. It was great to see Miles and Mina's wife and so many people there. Of course, Eric was there. And
it was so special having you there, too. And I got to say, even more special that you gave a shout out on Rates and Barrels. So now, you know, Amanda can say, oh, my gosh, I've been featured on New York Times. but more so that you endured the pod, that is the room that you had in your hotel, which we're not going to go into massive detail with, but it was very small where the toilet was in the shower. And I think that's where we're going to end that discussion. But thank you so much for being there, Eno. And it's a new year. The last podcast we did, we went over free agent pitchers and where they might land and what would be interesting predictions, all of that. And we've got some things to talk about. It's been about a month since we've done this podcast. And I want to start with the most recent discussion, which is this big trade that we've been talking about since, I don't know, June of last year. It's Edward Cabrera on the move and going to the Chicago Cubs. What is your first instinct with this? Is it the same guy? Is it better for Edward Cabrera? Where are you on this trade?
Yeah, I saw your analysis and it made me feel a little better. I mean, generally, what I like about Cabrera is he's changed his arm slot. It seemed to have a benefit to his command and his stuff. Actually, if you look at his breaking balls, there's way more separation between a slider and curveball. Like they used to kind of be like, you know, power curve and power slider, like kind of right next to each other. Now there's more separation. And the changeup got a little bit better, even got more movement at least. And so I like what the slot did for him that way. And there's some evidence that lower slots are slightly healthier because it's a little bit more like straight out from your shoulder as opposed to trying to.
For shoulder stuff going up. The thing I remember from college is actually when it comes to arm slots, it's always relative to your neck.
Yeah.
So if you're not moving your head, then it's going to hurt. But theoretically, you can do whatever you want as long as your body moves with it, you know?
Yeah, but then how does your back feel right now? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's not as bad as the shoulder, right? Okay, but natural arm slot is more likely going to be something like 3/4.
Right. So I like all those things. I hadn't yet sort of the projections I'm looking at for him have not been adjusted for his new park. So, you know, the my favorite projections are oopsie. And they have stuff plus in them. And you know, they say he's like basically a 3.7 ERA guy with basically what he was last year, you know. But that's in Miami. And what I liked from your analysis was you brought up the improved defense.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, the Cubs are an elite defense. The Marlins in the first half last year had Xavier Edwards at the at shortstop, which is not good. And then they believe it was Otto Lopez who took over. Was better in the second half, but the defense of the Cubs is why you have guys like Justin Steele and Cade Horton and Jameson Taillon doing so well with the Cubs. It's a major, major part of it. And Edward Cabrera, I think, is going to benefit from that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's then a question of like people. Mike Petriello, I think, was right to say that, like, you know, he's not necessarily a number two right now. It's more like could be, you know, there's a little bit of could be. There's a little bit of tension between what is he right now and what could he be. Mm-hmm. And so I just find that interesting with all of the free agents is this idea of like, what will his new team do with him? And how will he fit in? And so I think, you know, I think some of the park stuff gets undone by the better defense. So yes, it's a little bit worse park, but it is a park that's cold in the beginning of the year. So he'll start well at the beginning of the year. It suppresses righty power. That's a little bit less important for him, but he does have a great changeup. So if he has the great changeup and suppresses righty power, you could see those things working out. Then, you know, when it comes to something like what would they change about him? I mean, I think the thing that really sticks out is like this is a cut ride team. And if you just look at past last year's pitchers, their four-seam movement, you could say that Drew Pomerantz had a cut ride, Justin Steele had cut ride, Ryan Pressly, Cade Horton, obviously, Porter Hodge, Brad Keller. I mean, that's a lot of people that have that cut ride. So I think there's a little bit of this idea of like, will they cut ride his fastball? Like, are they able to do this to people, or is this a thing that they look for? Right.
Yeah. I'm inclined to think the latter. I mean, it's hard to find like a 36 degree arm angle guy. Like, I mean, this is really pretty traditional 3/4 arm slot to get cut right on it. I kind of interpret that of getting close to what I call the plane of 1,000 cuts, which is the y-axis. If you look at the, you know, the bullseye plot, right? Mm-hmm. The y-axis, and once it cuts over it, then that's really like Kyle Bradish territory and all, and some Dylan Cease fastballs, etc.
And he doesn't seem like that kind of guy, right? Like he's a changeup guy.
I'm looking at right now. We have this one of the many things I request of Kyle Bland. Yeah. Is that he makes a one sheet of every pitcher or starting pitcher for a team for me for the offseason that has all the data, everything I would want on those players, and I can just kind of like quickly go through them. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking right now at Edward Cabrera's movement chart.
And right. So what would you do? Like, what if they gave him a little bit of cut? So it's not a cut fastball, but it changes the four seam. I want a little bit of separation between that four seam and sinker. They're a little
absolutely. No, I'm with you on that completely. Yeah. To be honest, don't throw the four seamer.
Yeah, but then, okay, so then here's the other thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, Stuff Plus says, you know, and I'm sure that some of the numbers you're looking at right now say the sinker was good. I mean, it's high velo and, you know, it's high movement, right?
Yeah.
But as some people pointed out, like the actual results on the pitch were bad and pretty startlingly bad. And my first response was, you know, hey, year to year, like wOBA for starting pitchers is not that predictive, and it's not that year to year sticky. It's like a little bit better than the ERA, but it's not that great because wOBA, like, or anything, OPS, whatever, has all this noise in it. Defense, you know,
when does he throw it? And I hate, this is the thing I hate the most about, I've been pushing back on this for ages. Do not use results-based stats for pitches.
I think that's bad because if you do it for the pitcher, it's bad for the pitcher. If you do it for the pitch type, it's even worse because you're not only cutting your sample, but then you're forgetting how these things fit together.
I can't. Oh my gosh. You know, you're really hitting such a nerve with me here. It's like you're not you specifically. You're hitting.
I know this is like, more annoying recently.
Like the one I think the most that gets me is when people talk about splitters this way. I'm sorry, but it's like this splitter has a 0.48 batting average allowed. Yeah, because it's always in the dirt. Yeah. And then it only ends at bats when it's like a strikeout.
Can he throw it 3-0?
Right. No. Right. Like Tyler Glasnow has been known as the greatest curveball, but it's only because he throws it always in the dirt and it's generally in two strike counts and never for a walk, you know? Like, guys, it's not that simple.
And then somebody was like, well, somebody jumped in and goes, oh, well, you know, the exit velocity allowed on that pitch. I was like, oh man, now we're getting even worse because exit velocity is really bad. I mean, it's really not useful year to year. Like if you just look at exit velocity, it's that by pitcher allowed, like year to year, it's like worse, almost worse than Babbitt. It's like around there. So I think you're right. Like the count stuff here. So I think, I don't know if it's not, maybe it's throw the slider more in fastball counts. Maybe it's like throw the sinker less. Maybe it's just an acceptable amount of ownage on his sinker. Maybe it's okay if they hit a sinker because he's throwing it generally in like 2-0, 3-0 counts. And, you know, that's what's going to happen. You know, maybe throw the slider more in 2-0, 3-0 counts. Maybe improve the four seam some way that he can throw that. So there are ways for him to improve that are maybe not super obvious that leave off the page.
Well, okay. So with Eric Cabrera, the biggest thing that also really gets me about the conversation with him is like, I saw someone said, how can you trust this guy? He has a career 12% walk rate. And I just go, please stop doing this because he is not the same pitcher of old. I mean, I remember
that's
even
another thing. It's really hard to compare him.
The last 2 years, you know, it's been, oh, he's never going to get the walks down. He's going to get the walks down. But the conversation that should always happen when you talk about walks or strikeouts is, okay, what are his pitches and what do they do? I feel like Arnold Schwarzenegger. What are his pitches and what does he do? The sinker versus four-seamer. The four-seamer was the pitch that had the low strike rate. If you want to talk about walks, find the pitches that get strikes or don't get strikes. And are they throwing those a lot? And over the years, this four-seamer, what do you know? Oh my gosh, 59% strike rate, 50%, 57%, 63%. This year, 56%. It was second percentile in strike rate among all four-seamers. So what does Edward Cabrera do? He introduces the sinker instead, which, what do you know, has nearly a 70% strike rate.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go. The walk rate is solved. That is the conversation that should be had. And not just, well, he can't, you know, walk right, blah, 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 you know, right? It's like, that is it. We know the thing. We know how to be granular and actually find the thing that is creating the product, right? Mm-hmm. What is deriving this? So, you made a really good point, though, of, no surprise, the sinker is not good against lefties. It is really bad against lefties. I mean, I couldn't believe it when I saw it. First half versus second half for sinkers, ICR is the one I do for batted ball in play. That's ideal contact rate. It's combination of your barrel, but also your solids, the burners, the ones that are just generally good contact for hitters and based on launch angle and exit velocity and buckets, all of them. And you want to be under 40% on a fastball. So you want to be like 35. I'm like, beautiful, right? If I see 35% on a sinker, 30%, it's like, okay, you just throw this inside or same-handed batters, but that's great. His was like 51% in the first half and then like 70% to lefties in the second half. That is like the worst I've ever seen. And he threw it high. He started throwing high sinkers, Edward Cabrera. So I don't love that. The good news I have for you is that he didn't actually throw it too much. He threw it against left-handers only 14% of the time in the second half. And it's because he didn't have to. The changeup and curveball, 21% for the curveball, 29% for the changeup.
He just went real soft on them.
They're great. Well, I mean, is it really soft if your changeup's at 94.7?
That's right. That's true.
Right? I mean, that's the thing, though. He's recognizing, oh, right, my changeup kind of is a fastball. And it works really well against lefties. So I'm just going to throw that. That's the biggest change I would make. Like, you don't need, you can just throw the changeup. Just a little, maybe surprise with the front also, hip. So if you can, but just throw that.
The slider is a gyro slider and it's 89. I would suggest that he could throw that a little bit more against lefties too. Just to give him a different
20%
look.
Usage last year.
Yeah. Oh, so that is up because I'm looking at full year
numbers.
Yeah, that
was much lower before too. That's right.
It was 12% for the year. So yeah, he increased that in the second half. So maybe, you know, they just like some of the stuff he's already done. I mean, that's a, that's another thing that we, that happens when we sort of prognosticate about pitchers and stuff like that. We, you know, like, he's already done it. It's actually better, I think, when you've seen somebody already make some of the adjustments.
Oh gosh, yes.
You know, it's just testing. You know? Yeah, exactly. So I think he's found a place that, that'll work in Chicago. I have him right now, like 40, you know, I think that
40th.
Yeah. I don't,
yeah, it's, oh gosh, I don't know.
Where I don't I am. Really want to push him higher than that. I think that's
I don't know if I can, just because this is something I'm trying to do as much as I can, is go after guys who have done it fully once.
You know, yeah, and he's sort of like fully sort of once.
Ish. Sort fully of. Sort of.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, like he's right behind like Nady Evaldi and like,
right,
you know, Shane Bieber and, you know. Right now, the big toggle is he's behind a little bit of an injury tier where I have like Woodruff, Wheeler, and Bieber. If I can put him down, I have 158 innings. Precisely 158 innings is what he'll pitch this year. But if I decide that that's more like 165 or something, I could maybe put him ahead of, you know, somebody like even like a Woodruff or Wheeler, because I don't know what their inning totals are. I have them lower than that.
Yeah, it's hard because, like, I mean, Luzardo really was just bad for like four starts.
Look at that change in locations.
So look at this. This is part of, actually, I'll share this really quickly. This is the one sheet I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
And it's just everything. I can go to Shota over here. I can go to Edward Cabrera. So we have him projected right now 136 for 127, 25. I will yell at Kyle about the 9% walk rate.
Yeah, no, it's projections. You can't.
And then there's the movement chart. But what I really wanted to do was show you. So this. So slider locations in the second half. First of all, yeah, as you were mentioning, if you're watching this live on YouTube right now, you guys will see second half versus right-handed hitters. The slider finally moved down and away. He actually got it. In the first half, he was really struggling with it, actually doing front hip, which is no. Don't do that with your slider.
Yeah, that's the second half. That's what it's supposed to look like. And then he used it as a cutter against lefties.
Yes. And guess what? What's the velocity? Actually, by the way, it was 16%. I was quoting the 20% with right-handers, but still 16% is still higher than 12% usage for second half sliders. It's at 88, 89.
Yeah.
And this is where you want to throw a cutter.
Yeah.
So there's your cut fastball.
Yeah, right. So that's probably what the Cubs saw. It's like, we don't have to teach him anything. Like,
right,
he's got a cutter, you know. We'll just make him cutter change curve against lefties. A lot of people have had success against like that. Maybe he
absolutely
just dials down the four seam and sinker even more, you know, with the Cubs, and he's cutter change curve against lefties.
So this is what Edward Cabrera was doing with that sinker, as I was talking about upstairs. I mean, look at this. These charts by Kyle Bland here at Pitcherless are so good. They are not your strike zone plots. They are just heat maps relative to league average. And that just pretty much tells you, where is he throwing it, you know, more so or not than others, which is great. Like, it looks like that's exactly how he
command high, you know, that's,
and yeah.
So if you're asking him to throw a sinker high, then you're getting the same problem as when he threw his four seam high.
Right. So he was doing that a ton in the second half for whatever reason. And it was getting destroyed, but I did like this. He has a red dot inside and middle against right-handers, and that's what you want to see. You want to see jamming right-handers with your sinker.
Sort of front door sinkers, yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I reserve front door for, like, you go off the plate into the plate.
This is a whole ball to strike. Ball to strike. So it's not quite front door, ball to strike.
I apologize, you know.
This is like inside to middle. But
yeah, it's just like you're actually aiming it almost to go off the plate inside. And this is what I did. This is how I got through college. Was just throwing sinkers to college kids who try to open up, and then would just go inside and like jam them and grab all the third, you know. Who is the third baseman for the Cubs, by the way?
Yeah, I mean, there's rumors that it's going to be Bregman.
Well, if it's Bregman, oh my God, sign me up for Edward Cabrera and everyone else on that team. I mean,
you think Shaw's not a good defender?
I mean, I just know that Bregman's an elite one, right?
Yeah.
I don't know anything about Shaw. I'm sorry. Hopefully I'm not going to do a horse crossing redemption thing. I'm going to take back that.
Shaw had good defensive numbers. He's a young guy, so at least it's not you're not an old guy over there.
So that's Edward Cabrera. I mean, I feel like we can agree this is a positive change for Edward Cabrera. And or at least it really just leans into the fact that we thought he improved last year. Hopefully he's healthy. As you said, they approved the medicals as opposed to Luzardo.
And I actually think that they spend a lot more attention than a lot of clubs on health. Like first they said no to Luzardo. Second, they have a director of fatigue. You know, I don't know how many places have a director of fatigue, like Dr. Mike Son. So they are, I think they are thinking about health in, you know, in forward thinking ways. And then we know, at least from the outside, that they have an ethos when it comes to pitch development and what they like, you know? So,
yeah.
They're ahead of most teams, I think. And so what we're looking at with the Marlins is they have a good, I think this is going to be the theme of the episode in some ways, is sort of figuring out how teams, what they do and how that'll work with a new player. And figuring out what teams do is hard enough because the Marlins had a good reputation always for developing pitching, but how much of that is the park? And what I do know in the past is that they have been fascinated with unique fastball shapes, right? So not any one specific one, but unique fastball shapes. I think it's fair to say they love the power change because we've seen, you know, two or three pitchers now throw this a very similar sort of power change. Mm-hmm. So I would put the Marlins middle of the pack pitching wise.
I think they're really good at scouting.
Oh, maybe that's it.
I can't tell you an example of a player going to the Marlins and getting a good tweak,
but it's also hard because they don't sign guys and
that's really fair. But I mean, look at the Rays.
Yeah.
You know, they don't,
maybe middle behind. And I'd go middle ahead for the Cubs.
Yeah, I would actually say that it would be in the, if you had to say there are five tiers, I would say that the Cubs are either one or two.
Oh,
I very much trust what Zombro is doing now, especially as the director of pitching there.
Yeah,
I do have, if you guys don't know, Tyler Zombro was right there at the top of Trade Athletics. Everything I've heard from Tyone has just been like, this is awesome.
So what do you do if we were taking, just to force a transition here? How about Dustin May to the Cardinals?
Ooh. Oh, well, that's actually a very, very interesting one. I'll tell you guys after this break. So Dustin May to the Cardinals is what Eno asked. And, Eno, it's great to have you here. I think you got the good looking hair. No more of the Dustin May look. You know, no more of that, like the mini version of it. No, I mean, my first instinct with Dustin May to the Cardinals is this is a perfect match. What you want for Dustin May is to get volume, and then you want him to be in an environment where he can try to get grounders with the sinker. And if there's any place that we've seen that absolutely adores just guys who don't strike out a ton of batters but have actual success, I would say it's the Cardinals. It's a good home park. The biggest negative I'd say is I don't know where their defense stands now. Arenado is a year older, and I don't have the analysis in front of me of what I would consider that infield defense. I don't think they're really going to change Dustin May a whole lot, but I still feel like it's going to be fine. And 15 teamers, I'm like, yeah, that's kind of intriguing to me.
Here's something weird I found in preparation for this. The Cardinals threw the fourth fewest sinkers in baseball last year. I bet you could guess one of the three teams ahead of them, but I think you'd be surprised by the number one fewest sinkers in the game last year.
Okay, I would say Mariners are in there.
No.
Maybe not.
No, they're about middle of the pack.
Yeah. They actually incorporated them with Woo.
Think and, Florida.
Okay, must be Tampa Bay then.
Yeah. Tampa Bay, third fewest thinkers 50, in the game. 50, they've always been like a high four seam team, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess you would say the Red Sox just because they don't, but then Bayo exists. You know?
Yeah, Bayo, I think, probably changed it.
Yeah, right. They're in the fourth
team we just discussed. If you're throwing cut ride fastballs, you can't throw sinkers.
Yeah, no, the Cubs, yeah.
They threw the fewest, and then the Rangers also did not throw many. And then the other thing that was surprising to me is that the arm angle, when you do arm angle on those sinkers, like in terms of traditional, you know, worm burning side army sinkers. San Francisco does that. I think it's a lot of Logan Webb, probably.
Oh, yeah.
The average arm angle, San Francisco is the lowest on their sinkers. Colorado is second lowest. The Yankees were third lowest. And then you have Seattle and Diamondbacks who have some slingers, right? Mm. The St. Louis had the sixth highest arm angle on their sinkers. And I also looked at axis deviation to find, like, you know, seam shifted wake on sinkers, and Michael McGreevy was near the very top.
Oh yeah. McGreevy is like, oh yeah. I was trying to go through the rotation in my head, which is, by the way, that's a fun challenge right now for the St. Louis Cardinals. Yeah. McGreevy is your quintessential classic of just, I am going to go six innings and one strikeout, baby. Let's go.
But him and Dakota Hudson, and they've had,
Dakota Hudson.
They've had some few, like, three quarters sinker.
Yeah.
You know, right. Not quite. They're not like the Cardinal sinkers are not down here. They're
higher up. And it's, I mean, okay. So you have Andre Pallante who has the cut four seamer, right? I mean, that is a cutter, but it's not. Sonny Gray threw a four seamer that was a cutter, but he would throw front hip sinkers. I actually remember asking Pablo Lopez when he started to throw a sinker, it's a front hip sinker to lefties. He said, when Sonny Gray arrived here, and I saw him do it. I'm like, well, okay. Yeah. I gotta do that now.
That's fun too, because that's not coaching, but it is coaching. It's like from other players. It's like,
right,
you're like
that is one of the fun parts of the game too, is just it's the things you pick
so
up.
So it's, and like actually, Dustin May gonna learn from Michael McGreevy? Is that good or bad?
Well, right. Is Payne Tolley gonna learn from Garrett Crochet though, the cutter, right? Like, it's, you know, those kind of questions, right? And like Sonny Gray learned his sweeper from somebody else who put him in front of Rapsodo, and he was practicing his sweeper, and Sonny Gray's like, let me try that. He does it like the second time. And he gets really upset.
What would you have Dustin May do?
Dustin May, what a world he lives. I mean, I remember with the Dodgers, how I just wanted him to throw the cutter more and figure that one out. And I want him to be the four-pitch pitcher. I want him to be that sinker inside of righties. The four-seamer is flat enough that maybe he can get away with that against lefties with the cutter as well and play off of it. And then you have this amazing breaking ball. That really, he just, like, I watch Dustin May starts and I think of myself in high school when my coach, for whatever reason, had me start a game like 3 days later, as opposed to like the normal rest. And I remember by like the fourth inning, I was just throwing curveballs as my arm was just like, why am I here? And just hoping it goes over the plate. Like, that's what it is with Dustin May. It's like, I don't know how to get out of this because here's a sweeper. You know, and that's what he did a lot. Just a lot of filling up the zone with a sweeper. So you need some direction with that. But really, it's cutter with the sweeper to lefties, sweeper with the sinker to righties, four-seamer surprise upstairs. I think that's all you can really do. Maybe find a grip for a changeup if you can, because he is so sidewindy that maybe naturally that will just come.
Or like a knuckle curve where like the something that has a little bit more up-down movement. Like, he has nothing that's below zero and not the sweeper.
Well, the arm angle's so low. It's really hard to do that, right?
But I did some research on knuckle curves, and I found that, you know, one thing that knuckle curves can do for you is get a little bit more 12 to 6-ness than you'd expect given the slot.
Well, I'll tell you exactly why. Well, you've got a baseball, I'm sure. Do the knuckle curve.
Let me see where.
So your nail is like on top of the ball. It's like pushing down into the ball, right?
Uh-huh.
So now you're going to take your wrist as if it's going straight. You know, you're pointing at 12 o'clock with your knuckle. Now keep twisting it and go halfway and think about the pressure now that you have on it. Where is it going? It's going to the side now. It's not going down. I mean, you're not really supposed to push, but you're supposed to have it here, right?
Uh-huh.
And this is an awkward thing to get your nail straight. It's now on the side of it.
Uh-huh.
It's a completely different feel than if you're going over the top like this. Okay, you get depth, but it's not going to be easy to do it if you're at such a low arm angle.
Yeah. Right? But it allowed Nola has a little bit more 12 to 6-ness versus his slot.
Okay.
But Nola's not,
Nola's is Dustin May slower than Aaron Nola?
Yes.
Yeah. That's kind of, I'm thinking of like Brent Landon Roop right now.
Yeah. Like, so I don't know if this is true when it comes all the way down to the side. Like, I mean, even McGreevy is 33 and Dustin May is 21 degrees. So
21 degrees.
It's
21 is just, I mean, I'm just thinking to myself, like, it's pure frisbee time against righties. Like, that's just what you do. You have to. There's one skill. It's just Dustin May. No sinkers should ever be glove side. Just never. Just every single time, just become a master of it. Like Tanner Houck did. Sinker just always has to land arm side and on that edge. Just get that down. If you can do that, it will be so difficult because you have so much extra coming down the side like that. You just get all this horizontal movement. You just really do. And yeah, it has to be over there. Like, you're not going to command it at any time, like glove side. It's so much harder to do it there. That's the one thing I would focus on. And if you could do that, then you'll get right-handers out. And then it'll be a battle to figure out how you do left-handers. Maybe
I don't see it upside wise, you know, like I think that the ginger guard days are over. I mean, the oopsie projection that has stuff in it has like a 4.3 ERA projection with a 20% strikeout rate. I mean, I think he's useful in fantasy, and I think he's, you know, especially because you can play him half the time. And but like, if you're looking for a guy who's going to jump into the top 25 or something,
No, absolutely not.
I just don't see it anymore.
No, this is, I mean, but I guess what I'm getting at is Dustin May, I feel, is just getting overlooked completely again. And for understandable reasons. I mean, it was just really rough last year.
Yeah.
But now he's in a situation where actually he can get into rhythm. Like, he's got low, you know, high security, low anxiety about it. And he just gets to feast on that. And this is the kind of pitcher that the Cardinals have found value in. Remember when Miles Michaelis had like 200 innings of like three ERA or something? It was one of the top 20 player rater. I don't think he's Miles Michaelis in terms of command, but you can find a lot of value in someone like Dustin May. Maybe not on the whip side, but I could see a 3.7, 3.8 ERA over time. Like, I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but like, that's certainly within the realm of possibility here for Dustin May with the Cardinals.
Maybe this new arm slot is healthier for him, like Edward Cabrera.
We'll see. Yeah. Dylan Cease is now in Toronto. And I mean, okay, what are they going to do? I've been yelling through all my back channels possible to try to get the Dylan Cease to throw the cutter.
Yeah. Okay.
Every single resource I've had, any chance.
I've asked.
He did for like a moment. And I don't think he's going to return to that as much as I want him to. So what would you think that the Jays are going to do with Dylan Cease to ensure that he's not as volatile as he has been?
You know, one thing that I realized when I did a piece where I was like, oh, you know, these are the things that are predictive and these are the things that are not. And Cease was bad at the things that are not predictive and he was good at the things that are predictive. And so I got into this long argument with somebody that was using pitch type slugging percentage on Cease's four seam to say it was a bad pitch. And I was like, he's basically a two pitch guy. He has to throw that. He gets behind in counts. It's more of a command question that we're talking about here and size of arsenal. But I was thinking about like, what do the blue, and again, on the theme of our podcast today, what do the Blue Jays value? And here are two things I think they value. And it seems a little bit weird to say these about Cease at first, but first, innings. Cease is actually top five in innings over the last 5 years, 3 years, whatever. He's actually an innings guy. And they valued that. Oh, think about it. Bassett, Berrios, Gausman, those were all innings guys. Now, here's what I'm not sure, but I think they value, because they did get Gausman. Gausman's a two-pitch guy. So maybe they just say, hey, he's just our new Gausman. He's a two-pitch guy, and we're going to... And what did they do with Gausman? They said, throw some low fastballs. So they can, nobody can pigeonhole you and say, oh, it's high and hard, it's a fastball, it's low as a splitter, right? And that is actually the biggest thing that Gausman did in Toronto, was just start throwing more low fastballs. That could work for Cease. You know, Cease generally, we talked about this, me and him, he does throw low sometimes, but he generally throws the four seam high.
Right.
So maybe that's the Blue Jays tweak, is just, hey, throw some low fastballs. Bing, done. And then
now that could be
Brady Gausman.
I would say the I'm fine with that.
Gossman.
Would you say that he at any point really focuses in or out? Just using inside out.
I think
out
he doesn't have great command in or out. I think he think he's okay with up and down, and I think I think he gets lost. That's why the slide, the sinker that he's tried, you know, I don't think has really taken because it takes off.
Right. And it's and sinkers are phenomenal when you're able to locate it arm side against same hand and batters, right?
Yeah.
If it doesn't, then it's not, it's just a worse fastball.
Yeah. And he throws them high a lot. So there's something maybe just about his body where he's like, if I'm throwing it hard, it's going to be high, which Edward, his heat map is not as bad as Edward Cabrera's, actually. He does dot the top of the zone with the sinker a little bit. So maybe there's something there, but he could also be throwing those sinkers sort of mid low in tip righties, right? I don't know. Yeah. Like,
I mean, you can. You absolutely can. Yeah. I mean, if you have enough of it, then you can dive under the bat and then you get those grounders too, right?
He had some games where he threw a bunch of knuckle curves and it worked. But the stuff plus doesn't love the knuckle curve.
Well, he's also had a questionable feel of it. And this is the one thing that I would say I hope the Jays do not do is explore more of the same kinds of pitches.
Sweepers and knuckle curves.
Yeah, well, I've seen in the past, like, oh, here's a sweeper now. Here's, you know, here's that knuckle curve. Here are offerings that are essentially doing the same purpose as the slider, right? And that's why I've been saying the cutter should be it. And you don't even need to get it up and in. You can just do it as a backdoor strike to lefties if you want, which isn't too common. But I think honestly,
he's worried that like he's kind of a cut ride guy with the four seam.
Yeah.
Oh, and then he's got a gyro slider. So if he does a cut fastball, I do see a space on it there, but it would just be another thing that's up and down.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, it's not going to be side to side as you'd want it to be.
And maybe they would just all blend together.
Oh man, it's tough. I mean, I think you've got it of changing north south as much as you can, right? Maybe he can do the Cannibal McSanchez, which I know sounds wild. If you don't know what that is, it's a combination of Anibal Sanchez and Colin McHugh. Because they both had these like weird breakout seasons where they threw high four seamers and high cutters, where they had these amazing called strike numbers on cutters because they would come back down into the zone. And so they would land at the top of it.
Slider, throw some high sliders, and kind of go. There we got it. We got it. High sliders and low fastballs.
There it is. If you play MLB The Show, you know how annoying that is.
Is actually a modern pitch.
Right.
I don't think that people used to throw those. And now I think announcers who played the game before a lot of times say, oh, that was a hanger. And you're like, no, dude, the catcher put his glove up there. That they meant to throw that high slider.
Yeah, I absolutely.
Not every high slider is a hanger.
I do all the time. I mean, I remember Giolito saying it about the high changeup, about him being cool with it. Because they're just saying, oh my God, that's the fastball, and then like swing straight through. And his isn't like the biggest drop.
And his looks like a hanger. It looks like a hanger. It's like doesn't look like anything. I could, people call those hangers all the time. I'm sure he meant to do that for sure.
His
heat map on the changeup is that. Yeah.
I will find it hard to believe in the hanging slider not being a hanging slider. I'm really sorry. It will just take some time for me. But if they're
throwing it, like, right? You know that they throw sliders high on purpose sometimes.
Oh, yes, I do.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But I can't tell you when. And maybe it's 0-0 and 1-0. Okay. And I'm just going to play the odds. I'm going to say no. I will say this about Dylan Cease is that he isn't too different from year to year. Sometimes it's okay, higher strike rate on the curveball to lefties or sliders to lefties. So, I mean, last year he really struggled actually doing the typical down and away slider.
Slightly better and slightly worse.
Right. Year. And we see these big shifts. And it's really like, no, he's really in the middle of it. It's just that I try to think about this all the time. When you see a full season of 30 starts or whatever, you're going to have 10 where you're feeling great, 10 that you're feeling bad, and then 10 that can go either way. And a lot of times the bad are just so much worse, and you don't have such a good on the good side that okay, now I have a 5-year A season versus a 3.
Or sometimes the ones in the middle just all go the wrong way because it's not a great year for command.
So it's not one of those things of like, well, he is broken now, and thus he can't be unless something happens. Maybe he could just do more of it, and he's okay. I understand why the Jays are willing to take that chance.
He has slid a little bit for me over time because, you know, as he accrues bad stats, that it's going to show up in the projections and stuff. So I've got about a 3.7 ERA, but great strikeout rate, 28% strikeout rate. So I've got him kind of close to Drew Rasmussen.
Who would you rather have, Rasmussen or Cease?
I have Rasmussen one ahead, okay? In my working ranks.
Come on, Nick. I have Rasmussen.
I think he's also interesting next to Chase Burns too. Like,
yeah,
you know, don't know the innings. Similar. You're going to get strikeouts. Don't know. About
I would rather have Cease because the innings are going to be better.
That's true.
And it's going to be strikeouts too. And at least I've seen Cease have an amazing season.
The oopsie projection for Chase Burns is 3.07.
We love Chase Burns too over here. Yeah. Yeah.
It's hard.
The four seam is a little more harder to hit with Chase Burns, but I will say I've seen some around the same area of it. And I think it's more about team context, about your building. Do you get a lower strikeout guy initially, more ratio focused? Okay. Then you can take that with ERA and get the strikouts with Cease. He is one of the latest guys you can get for 200 strikeouts.
Yeah. Like if you got Logan Webb or Fromber, like he's actually a pretty good pairing. If you took a risky first, like if you took a Jake DeGrom first, I think going with Chase Burns would be like, woof, you're either or you are, you got zero.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I wanted to talk about a few others and do a little bit quicker hits on them, including the Giants, as we hinted at before, with Michael King returning to San Diego, Merrill Kelly going to Arizona, and one or two surprise ones for Eno. We'll talk about them after this break. Okay. So I just want to get this one out of the way here. Michael King returning to the Padres. I love it because I think what the Padres did for Michael King initially was great. I think he is really in a good spot there and he just needs health. Hopefully he is healthy. But I mean, is there anything alarming about this for you that you think, okay, cool, this is what they're going to do now for Michael King?
No, I think it's pretty simple to prognosticate on him. It's just, is he healthy or not?
Absolutely. Good. I love him. Merrill Kelly's back with Arizona. Sweet. We like that one. Same kind of thing. The Arizona team is going to be a little bit worse. But yeah,
just the thing that's interesting about Kelly is just that he doesn't project well, you know,
right,
every year. And, you know, I want to say he doesn't project well every year and he does well every year, but he had his first year in Arizona, 4.42 ERA, 2021, 4.44, 2024, 4.03. So like there's always a chance that he just has a 4 ERA. But one thing that's been true for almost, I think pretty much every year, is a good whip. You know, so yeah. I think what you're looking at is just a guy who commands it well, has a good arsenal, and, you know, still throws 92. Now, what happens if he's 89, 90 in spring? Do you get worried at all?
Oh, yeah. Well, in the spring, no, I can't.
Okay.
I look, as someone who's done the Plus Pitch podcast and then last year even did the roundup essentially for spring training, like none of the it's such a low correlation.
Yeah.
Of what we see in the spring carrying over. They'll get
too many guys that approach it differently. Some guys want to be, you know, full on ready to go right away. And some guys just use spring to basically ramp up.
Yeah. I'd like to do the rule of the young guys are generally going to be at their velocity early. While any vet that has a secure position, you just don't think about it.
I'll get there eventually. Even Tyler Mahle, who's now, he didn't have a great year velocity wise, but he was really bad in spring and he did at least get back up to 92.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think that like the upside, his 2.18 ERA last year, I think is mostly a mirage.
Completely.
And I don't think that the upside that he showed, you know, in 2020, 2021 in Cincinnati is there without him throwing 94.
Right.
So I think he's mostly just a guy who you'd use at home. You might use it in some select places, but I don't think he'll be an asset for strikeouts. Hauser even less so, but they maybe have a type with these guys that they're looking at. Both Hauser and Mahle were top 30 in location plus last year and over the last 3 years. So they're just like, hey, let's just take guys with decently wide arsenals in command and let them throw in front of Bailey and in this park. And, they'll be our 4 and 5s. Like, I just don't.
We talked about different types of upside. And look, Adrian Hauser and Tyler Mahle easily could be like 4 year A guy in San Francisco. 15 teamers, if they're going consistently, like they will get wins. They will go deeper into games. They'll let them go 90 plus pitches. Adrian Hauser added extension last year and was able to locate.
The bullpen might not get them the wins, though. The bullpen's not very good.
Oh, is it not?
No, I mean, it's like Ryan Walker and Jover Peguero. No. Like, it's a Ryan Walker. It's a 100-mile sinker behind him, but it's two sinkers at the back end of the rotation, at the back end of the bullpen.
Oh, so. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
And, you know, how much consideration do you put into bullpen?
Yeah. I mean, wins are like, I think, so hard to project.
Yeah.
So I usually just, I don't put wins in my rankings.
Huh.
I don't put projected wins in my rankings. Think about it.
Chance of 90 plus pitches. That's the way I see it.
Mm.
Like, what is their runway in a start? And that should be an indication.
You know, there are enough people who are playing with quality starts, and there's a new stat called QA3, which is like,
well, yeah, it's on Fantrax. Yep.
Third order quality starts or something. But it's like, you know what? You know, what those things do is they do make you think, even like a Rasmussen type. We love Rasmussen. How many times is he going to go six? You know, how many times is, you know, he does go five, you know, so he gets more value in those quality starts in QA3 leagues. But if you want wins, sure, you know, it can get tough.
Yeah. So, I mean, generally you do want to chase teams that win.
but who gets further in games? It's mostly wide arsenals with command.
Yeah, exactly. That's absolutely right. Also those who actually are sinker ballers, because they convert outs faster. Sinker ballers are going to get more balls in play in earlier in counts, especially those who are strike throwers. So it's kind of why you see these strike throwing arms, Merrill Kelly.
And Snell and Cease are the opposite, where they don't go as deep. They have to be really efficient. They have to have really good command to get into the seventh and eighth. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's why you see fewer strikeouts, but then the volume, that's why it's Logan Webb. You know, he gets to the eighth, but it's only 22% carry, but it doesn't matter. He led the league in strikeouts, you know?
So Mahlenhauser, I would just kind of, they're not both like ground ballers, because Mahle throws a high four seam.
Yeah. Well, right.
Right.
100%.
Hauser is. Efficiency, but you could think of them as sort of like bulky ground ball-y guys that could help you without, even if they'll be bypassed, because I don't think that they will be on anybody's list of like, oh, these are, you know, five hot young breakout starters.
I'm happy you ended with breakout starters. I'm with you there. I think of these as, you know, it's kind of funny. I don't play in too many 15 team leagues, but the ones I do are always the fun ones for me. So like last year I drafted Merrill Kelly and Matthew Boyd, because I was like, let's go. These are the guys I love for them, you know?
Yeah.
And I see like Hauser and Mahle. I'm like, that's okay. A little reserve there for that.
But Mahle a little bit more, but yeah.
First stream or so.
Yeah. Mahle a little bit more, because I think Hauser could end up in the pen. We'll see.
Yeah. That was a wild season last year, but I'm not going to go into that anymore. I do want to talk about, hey, look, we haven't done this podcast. I know you guys are probably sick of it by now, but we have to talk about Tatsuya Imai to the Astros, right? And I'll be honest with you. Hi, everyone. I'm a baseball fan. I grew up as a Yankee fan. However, everybody will tell you that I root for the pitcher on the mound more than anything. And also, I do not like the Astros because they cheated. All right. Otherwise, I was really like, I loved it. I remember that World Series of Dodgers. I thought that was so exciting and great. And I was not, even after they beat the Yankees, I was like, this is what a wonderful series and stuff. And they found out and it stinks. And I saw that MI went to Houston and I had two reactions, you know. One, oh man, that's going to be a fun place for him to go. It's a perfect fit. Two, I hate this. Right? and the way I see it, yeah, six man should come. So it doesn't really kick out anyone in that rotation in the first place. Second, they're going to let him, you know, I think of Houston, I don't think of a team that, unless you're a really limited starter like Jason Alexander, for example, who just really had only a changeup, that they will let you go. They will push. They will say 90 pitches plus. They will actually let you travel into games. And even though there has been a lot of brain drain from Houston in that department, I still would classify them at the very minimal as average. if not still slightly above average, as far as being able to make those tweaks and work with them. And with Amai, he just seems to me like he's made to survive. Not necessarily be like the top 15 guy, not like a Yamamoto necessarily from everything that I've read, but a very capable pitcher. And that to me is like, cool, this is just like a safe starter that is going to go, you know, hopefully 28 to 30 starts and like 150 innings and maybe 140. You know, I'm curious to hear your take on Amai.
Well, I was really excited when I did some fastball comps and Joe Ryan was on the list, but Luis Castillo is on there too. So, and I think to be honest, once you think about how the ball changes movement, you know, the difference in ball changes movement, I think probably Luis Castillo fastball comp is right. And so you've got a Luis Castillo four-seam fastball. However, it's a little bit, it's got a little more giddy app because he might have touched 100 and he sat 95. So I think he'll come over and sit 96. So now you're like, okay, Luis Castillo's four-seam was a lot better when it was harder. So, okay. So now you're like, okay, Luis Castillo, 96 mile an hour four-seam. Splitters are just hard to comp, but I'm going to give him a plus splitter. You know, even Sugano, who came over, who was so boring, the splitter was good. Like, it's
was his best pitch. Sugano a little bit. He's like, oh, this is a sneaky thing for the Orioles. Okay. Yeah.
But so I'm going to give him a plus splitter. The big question is the slider is there are comps. The comps are really weird. Jose Urania's slider worked like that.
You know, that was his best pitch, though.
That's a good point. So what's weird about a slider is it goes the wrong direction, like Trey Yosavage's.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It's like a gyro that has arm side movement.
Yeah.
However, the people that throw breaking balls that have arm side movement are generally more like Yosavage. They're usually high guys.
Yeah.
Cole Mentor threw a curveball that went the wrong way, you know? And I think it's just, you almost are releasing it inside. I don't know what exactly why, but
Shooto.
Yeah. It's a kind of a Shooto ish. And so when you limit it to low slot guys, because think about it, how is he throwing a slider that has arm side movement with a 22 degree arm angle? That's what he's doing.
So, okay. That's awesome. So if you guys don't know, really Shooto, it's the pitch that I accidentally threw in college. Because I thought, I mean, I naturally had the seam shifted wake and I was throwing a two seamer with my index finger and my middle finger, essentially both on the right side of the seam, not both inside down the tracks, but actually my middle finger on the right side of that seam. And I always thought as I was doing it, what was happening was my fingers were coming across the seams and turning it this way and turning over kind of like a change up. Right. Mm-hmm. And then getting that movement this way. But in actuality, I was just releasing it like this and getting the seam shifted wake. Right. But when I wanted to do a backdoor sinker, I really wanted to emphasize it. So I actually remember thinking in my head, just the focus of this index finger and pushing down as much as I could on release. And that gets the Shooto movement. That's actually what a Shooto is, right? Going that in that direction.
It's bullet spin. It's close to a gyro slider, right?
Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's actually what he's doing, because he's so low. He's pronating so much that he's coming across it almost like a circle changeup of like Jarrell Cotton's. Right.
Maybe.
And then doing that's my guess. That's why it's just Shooto. It was like a legendary, you know,
we need to see more of it. I mean, Kirby Yates popped as a possible comp because Kirby Yates throws this kind of slider very rarely. Mm-hmm. But again, if it's Kirby Yates at 96 for five innings, you know, something depends on the slider. Something depends on the slider, because as you know, as you talk about, you're a little bit riskier if you're a four seam splitter guy. I mean, if you're a fastball splitter guy and you don't have a breaking ball. So,
oh, completely.
I was doing these comps at first. I was like, oh my God, Joe Ryan. Yeah, this is a great comp. You know, oh my God, if you could get Joe Ryan at 96, you know,
Joe Ryan throws a splitter too. Yeah.
Younger Joe Ryan. Poof, let's do it. And Joe Ryan has struggled to find his breaking balls. I mean, he has two of them, but they're not great. He's more, he's kind of a four-seam splitter guy with okay breaking balls.
So oh, yeah. Like, no, it's
Joe Ryan is the comp.
Yeah.
And then I did the secondary complex and I was like, oh God, Jose Urania. Oh,
yeah, but that's no. Urania. Everybody's a major leaguer for a reason. And it was the slider with like sinkers, hopefully at getting outs was
what
Urania is.
If you look at pitch plot movements, Urania just had a sinker where Imai has like a four seamer that's different. Like he has two fastballs.
Yeah, yeah. Nice. And
they're different enough, you know, that, you know. So anyway, the thing that has bothered me is the contract. The contract number bothers me.
No, it's the opposite for me.
I think it's too low.
Well, it is, but okay. So if it were a confirmed, like locked in, no opt outs contract,
that would be worse. That would be worse.
But because it's a bet on me contract.
Yeah.
And that to me says two things. One, that Imai is not going to like settle in. Like he's going to be, he's going to.
You know, also, if you know anything about his like demeanor and what he's like, he wants to dominate. He's a gamer. Yeah.
I love it. Oh, I love it. You know, but I mean, right. Like I didn't mean like a video gamer. Like he's a, you know.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, his quote about the Dodgers, I don't want to play for the Dodgers. I want to beat the Dodgers. I'm like, exactly. Yeah. That is what I yell about every single like superstar or whatever. Why are you making these super teams? That's purpose in life sucks. Then you got to be better than that. You got to want more. So Imai to me in that situation, it's like 18 million. It's not like it's nothing, right? Is going to get a massive contract next year, and like I see this completely as, I'm better than this. All right, give me 18 million.
He'll opt out. Yeah.
And Boris has done this multiple times with guys. You know, I mean, we just saw Pete Alonso do it. And kill it, right? I believe Cody Bellinger just did it too. And I feel like he's going to be all right with it. There's some more I can't remember off the top of my head, but like this is, this to me seems like textbook of.
But also, it's just
he's a little unknown, but he's still being 18 million for the year.
The number being so low just bothered me because it meant that, like, you know, there weren't a lot of teams that thought that, you know, this was great stuff and they needed to get it.
Yeah,
there were some projections that said 150 million and stuff, you know, like,
yeah, I do wonder what the suitors like if he purposely knocked out certain ones that would have been the typical ones. So like he said,
what if there were some people that said 5 and 50 and they, you know, there was more money, right? It was locked in at 5 years and they wanted to like, you know, lock in that upside.
Exactly. And he's like, no, it's a. He's like, no, I'll be good, great for 1 year and this will be amazing. Like, I'm good. And he has another one. Even if he gets hurt, he has another opt out. Like every year is an opt out.
Yeah.
So I feel very much of like, this is, I don't know.
I've got him.
The haze is there because the ball is different and you don't know how it's going to adapt coming here and stuff, et cetera, et cetera. And I get that. And also with the lockout coming, I think that more teams are just, you know, more hesitant with the potential lockout.
How about this? Would you rather?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Imai or Lodolo?
Oh man,
I have the
my right. Heart says Imai.
All right,
my heart says Imai. I think with Lodolo, I don't want to get too wrapped up in the fact that he finally had a healthy season. And I don't really care so much about the park. I was actually doing some park factor stuff yesterday, and realizing that yes, there are more home runs in Cincinnati. Everything else, including like strikeouts, are better for the pitcher.
There's
like a lot of things that are good for the pitcher with Cincinnati, which is kind of interesting. And Lodolo was really good at like changeups, and he was a swatch king, you know, southpaw with a tight changeup. But I think Imai is going to get more wins, and I think Imai is safer. So I'm going to do that because I have to take both of them inside my top 40. So I'm going to have Imai. Mm-hmm. You?
Yeah, I have him right the back of the top 40.
Yeah, it's probably around like 35 or so. Something like that.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I've got Lodolo 37, Imai 38.
Yeah. That whole area is getting weird now because then, I mean, I'm low on McClain and everyone is yelling at me, but I don't care. But there's like Trevor Rogers, who I just covered. And Trevor Rogers, that's a whole nother story of what on earth. And we'll say that for the next episode.
I think generally that I've circled sort of 30 through 40 as being really difficult because you've got hype young guys that you need to fit in there somewhere. And you've got old guys, and a lot of them are injured or have bad injury histories. So like, where, like, how does Nathan Eovaldi go against Cam Schlittler? Like,
yeah,
these are, you know, totally different things. I think I can count on Eovaldi for 140 good innings, but maybe Cam Schlittler can give me 175 amazing innings.
I would, I mean, the way you're describing it there, if I get 140 out of Eovaldi, I would rather take that. The conversation we had at the end of the season was, what were the lessons of 2025? And one of them for us was, don't take the premium volume guys, so like in the top 25, but go for the ones at 30 to 50. That's where the volume, that's where the value is. Mm. And then when it comes to the hype boys, you don't go for the hype boys. just let someone else do it, because it's, yeah, it's too much wish casting. That was the takeaway, like, I had, even though, yeah, I had
today, even in our conversation, you know, Cease, yep. Gossman, you know, these are guys that I have with 180 innings in that 30 to 50 range that are going below where I might have them ranked.
Right. Like Gossman, for example, I don't actually have as close as the others. I like him less.
Pavetta, I have down for 190 innings, 180.
Oh,
Pavetta
is part of my premium crowd, though. He's in my top 30.
Yeah, I've got him 32.
Yeah. So it's so we'll talk about our rankings also. I can't wait for that one. That's going to be just both of us go, oh yeah, for like a good hour. Oh man. I said I had a couple guys I want to surprise you with. I really can't wait to hear your take on this one. Is this the year that we finally care about Michael Lorenzen as you went to
in Colorado? No.
Because, you know, oh, I meant the hitter, Eno.
Oh, okay, good. maybe this is a play for that exception. There is the roster exception. Where you can get more pitchers if you designate somebody a two-way player.
Oh my God.
They're trying.
Well, hold on. This is the Rockies we're talking about.
No, but it's the new Rockies.
You think, oh, it's the new Rockies?
I mean, yeah, Paul DePodesta.
Oh, that's right. Burns. Oh, man.
Josh Burns just came from the Dodgers. So I could see them actually, you know, trying to sneak a 14th pitcher onto that roster by calling him their third center fielder.
I cannot wait for the pinch hit performance.
They'll have to do something early on to define it. I mean, I don't know, maybe all spring he'll have to hit. I don't know.
Was he going to go like 2 for 13 or something? Like, hey, all right.
Yeah, what's the conversation like with the league officer? Like, dude, we know what you're doing. No, man, we're really serious. Lorenzen, do you think he could be one of our best outfielders, man? Have you seen his arm? Like, he's
a DH.
He'd be the best arm in the outfield. Yeah.
Oh, God. But the actual one I did want to discuss with you is, there was a move that that was made in the Northeast, and it's Johan Oviedo to the Red Sox. And I have had a mini obsession with Oviedo for a bit, even when he was with the Cardinals.
Well, he's totally different than...
Well, now he's even better. Yeah. So he comes back from Tommy John.
You like him even more.
And exactly. He had a 7'1" extension. Now it's 7'5". His VAA...
Fastball is completely different.
It's flat. It even has more vert than expected based on the arm angle.
Definitely.
And he's throwing at 95, 96. Excuse me, that's the Fan 4 Plus. Dings all across the board. We were going nuts with the lights. And the problem is that he can't throw strikes with him.
And he also
cannot locate this thing upstairs as he needs to. But he can with his slider. He can with his curveball.
But pitches aren't good by stuff.
The slider is just going to be reliable over the years for Oviedo.
Maybe it'd just be completely backwards where the four seam is for some whiffs.
Or maybe the Red Sox look at this and go, we're going to figure this out. Because all we got to do is just get you to throw your fastball here. And I'm going to say his name again. It's better Joe Ryan fastball if you just do that.
Oh, yeah. So, or it has some similarities to Toley, actually.
Oh, yeah. On the right side. Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the very least, he does have a reliable slider and curveball. I mean, that's how he got through games. That was a strike rates galore through those pitches and whatever. And the fourth teamer had literally 53.7% strike rate.
Stuff doesn't like him.
Well, that's stuff.
Stuff used to like him, though.
Well, okay, this stuff must love the four seamer.
It does. It loves the four seam.
Like, what is it at?
115, which is really good.
Oh man, just get that. But
the stuff less on the slider, which had been pretty good, and I think when you talk about reliable, it was like a 105, 110, like just a average-ish above average slider. But then it went to 97.
Oh no, I won't take that. But all right, so this is what I'm very intrigued by with the Red Sox. See what happens here, because they traded for him with the intent to be in the rotation, is my understanding.
But he also has an option.
Oh, he has an option. Oh, that's such a great point, you know.
Oh, it sucks.
It's Kyle Harrison 2.0.
We will have an episode where we just talk about, I think, roster battles a little bit.
Oh, we absolutely will. We're thinking about it for today. You know, suggested it, which we 100% will do.
Too much movement to happen.
Yeah, the audible of saying, let's wait until we're right before camp.
But this is one I have circled because Patrick Sandoval is kind of boring, but they gave him a 2-year deal.
Yeah, and they didn't get anything the first year, so it's $18 million there, just hanging out.
They wanted something. They wanted for something. I think Cutter Crawford, you know, just the injuries, like maybe he just needs to go to the pen. And then everyone's excited about Tolian Early, but right now they have tons of options. It wouldn't even be that crazy to send him back to the minors, and they're listed on Fangraphs as like, what is that? 7th and 8th.
Don't do that. Connelly Early is so good. And I know you're right. You know,
the rankings based on talent versus, you know, what's actually going to happen.
There's also this conversation to have, though, is Eric Samulski has been mentioning Patrick Sandoval to me for the last like 5 months as I talk about Connelly Early. And he's just saying, Patrick Sandoval, like, I don't care. You know?
Yeah, right.
Like, I'm throwing the chair at him, you know, that gift. The guy with the walrus mustache. But the Red Sox are in the AL East, y'all. And the AL East is going to be one incredible bloodbath of a division, I think. Because all five teams, yes, even the Rays, because the Rays are the Rays, and who knows, are going to be
good
fighting for this, you know, 95 win season, right?
Yeah.
And if the Red Sox exit camp in April, they give like Sandoval 4 starts. Are they really willing to do that when they have someone like Connelly Early ready to go? And maybe they will, but I would be thinking they have to go and be the best team they can from day one, because they will be wanting those games September 20th, right?
And it's like, I know that sunk cost is like a fallacy or whatever, like, but like teams have different approach. Like teams, $18 million means different things to different teams.
Yeah.
And I think to this team, a 1 year, $18 million, they could just say, I'm sorry, DFA, you know, or just like,
well, oh, tell it to the people who saw Mookie Betts and Rafael Devers leave, right? This team cares about money.
It does, but not on like a 1 year. They just don't care. Okay. They don't want to do the $300-400 million contracts.
Okay.
They don't like length. So on a 1 year deal, I could see them being like, oh, Padres, you pay $5 million, you get free Patrick Sandoval.
Free. Well,
right,
like give us a relief. Yeah, I mean, maybe that does happen. Maybe also like spring training, they're hoping he showcases something, or like one start and he's gone or whatever. But
I don't know.
I just wish it's Connelly Early. I think Connelly Early is just such a
phenomenal. My esteem of Cutter Crawford is dropping. I just the projections are, he's been he's never figured out Fenway, and he could just be a pretty good reliever, and he's just been so hurt. That's the one where I'm like, that's could be where Oviedo sneaks in, and then Tolian Early would have to sneak into the Patrick Sandoval slot. Another thing they might do is take Sandoval into the season as their five, and then hope that either injury gets Tolian Early in there, or when they DFA him or whatever, it's during the season when it's a little bit harder, when people's rosters are more set. You know, they don't want
to
DFA.
It's found money to them in this way of like, if we can get value out of this, they will. It's kind of like why the Yankees used Carlos Carrasco last year instead of Will Warren, right?
Yeah.
And still
similar idea, because who has options? Okay, right. Tolian Early have options. They're going down.
Yeah.
But like, you know, they'll be back in April.
So I'm going to end this by saying that the Red Sox are clearly just going to trade Cutter Crawford and do what Hunter Dobbins, you know, the whole thing. Duh. It's set in stone. I think we've already talked about Sonny Gray being on the Red Sox before. I think it's a very interesting thing. I think it's actually not a bad idea. And that should be fine.
They have anything they have to change on him. He's just, maybe he throws his sweeper a little bit less, or I don't know. Maybe he throws his fastballs less. I don't know.
Yeah. But and
he's just been a great K minus BB guy. And like,
and here's the thing. Zach Eflin is going to be the value of your draft.
There you go.
He's going to be the value of your draft. He got back surgery. He's not even like in the top 250, and he's going to be going regularly without the back hurting as much as it did last year for a winning team. It's 90 plus pitches. It's exactly the kind of thing. It's like, think of Tyler Malley and Adrian Houser, but better.
All right.
There it is. You heard it here first. Ian Osaris, what can we expect from you at The Athletic in the near future?
I'm trying to hash out a piece about Patrick Bailey, pitching to Patrick Bailey in San Francisco. You know, one of the things that's interesting is that, like, you pitch in San Francisco, you get your ERA goes down because it's a nice park. And, you know, we talk about this. What is your actual true talent? And teams, though, are going to be able to strip all that out. So you can't go to San Francisco and, you know, pitch to a 3.6 ERA after being a 4.2 guy and be like, I'm a 3.6 guy now. Every team's going to be like, no,
yeah, right.
Just still 4.2. Yeah. Right. So kind of trying to talk about the phenomenon that is, like, you know, being San Francisco wanted to be a destination for pillow contracts, and whether that's, you know, if pitchers, if that's the best idea for pitchers, and, like, you know, what that means. So
that's
working on that with Andrew Baggerly. And then, you know, all of my pitcher ranks and all that stuff. So our position previews start on Rates and Barrels next week.
Nice. And when does the spring battles article come out? I think you might be doing it with somebody. I don't know. Just kidding. You know, I'm absolutely kidding. But I look forward to that on Rates and Barrels, of course, with Derek Van Riper. We are, what, like a month and a half away from spring training games at this point? Pitchers and catchers and like...
Not even, games? Dude.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, yeah, I guess a month and a half, but...
It's getting close, which means I have a lot more teams to cover.
Sabre Seminar.
Ooh.
February 27th through 30th. So I'm going to be in spring training in Arizona in February.
Oh man. And I have to get my act together to ensure that we have PitchCon arriving January 29th for 4 days. All right. So look out for that. It's going to be on twitch.tv/pitchless because I'm streaming there now.
Not welcome back.
Welcome back. That's right. But definitely check out PitchCon 2026. I hope we can steal Eno for that. But that is it, guys. So on the behalf of wonderful guest, Eno Saris, my name is Nick Pollock. We'll talk about the craft of pitching again next week.